From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! It's been more than 60 days that the bombs have been dropping. Unless Congress consents, the bombs should stop falling. We'll talk with attorney Michael Ratner about the War Powers Act. Also, a look at guns and the gun industry's influence in U.S. politics. And Jeremy Scahill reports from Belgrade. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today has been NATO's busiest day of the air war so far. Allied officials say their pilots flew a record 650 raids in the last 24 hours. Of those, about 40% were attack flights hitting tanks and artillery in Kosovo. Other targets include a presidential villa that had a command and control bunker, a police station, and a train tunnel are also among the sites hit. Meanwhile, NATO says it's quickly moving forward with plans to increase its Kosovo peacekeeping force. Some 14,000 Western troops are already standing by in Macedonia, waiting to cross the border once the war ends. Russia's special envoy on Kosovo is meeting again today with U.S. envoy Strobe Talbot and the president of Finland. Russian envoy Viktor Chernomyrdin says he hopes today's talks will lead to an immediate halt to NATO strikes. He says NATO's steady escalation of the attacks could wreck political negotiations. Chernomyrdin says Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic may agree to having NATO peacekeeping troops in Kosovo, as long as the troops are from NATO countries which aren't directly involved in the current bombing campaign. Meanwhile, diplomatic efforts to resolve the Kosovo crisis continue. Greek Foreign Minister George Papandreou meets in Washington today with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and other senior U.S. officials. Papandreou says he is convinced international mediation could end the conflict quickly. Papandreou is promoting a 48-hour pause in NATO's bombing of Yugoslavia. He says that would give President Milosevic time to consider a response to NATO demands for withdrawal of all Serb troops from Kosovo and the stationing of foreign peacekeepers in the province. Two Kosovo Albanians living in the United States are suing Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic, his wife, and a dozen other Serb leaders. They're alleging genocide and other war crimes. The federal suit was filed in Boston. It asks the court to allow the two men and other Kosovar immigrants access to millions of dollars of assets belonging to Yugoslav leaders and their government that have been frozen by the U.S. With one New York City police officer suddenly pleading guilty in the torture trial of Haitian immigrant Abner Louima, the lawyer for another hopes to stop the trial. When court resumes today, the lawyer will ask for a mistrial. He represents one of four other officers also accused of torturing Abner Louima. Justin Volpe threw in the towel yesterday after a series of damaging witnesses. Prosecutors refused to give him a plea bargain, leaving Volpe to tell the court how he sodomized Abner Louima in a precinct bathroom. Other defense lawyers doubt there will be a mistrial. They expect the judge will continue the trial after explaining what happened to jurors who weren't on hand to hear Volpe's confession. There's word of intense fighting along India's disputed border with Pakistan. Pakistani officials say Indian aircraft have bombed Pakistani territory in the Kashmir province. An army spokesperson calls it a very grave escalation and says his armed forces reserve the right to respond. It marks the most serious escalation of fighting in the region since India and Pakistan tested nuclear weapons last year. Los Angeles and San Francisco plan to file lawsuits against the handgun industry, joining other cities' attempts to pressure gun makers to control sales and add safety features. Los Angeles City Attorney James Hahn told the Los Angeles Times his lawsuit would target manufacturers that are operating with, quote, deliberate indifference to gun violence. The Senate has voted unanimously to fund prosecution of suspected Balkan war criminals. The non-binding measure authorizes $18 million to help an international tribunal in The Hague, Netherlands, expand its probe of Balkan crimes, including those committed in Kosovo. In an amendment to a Pentagon spending bill, the Senate also recommended that amnesty for those who might be indicted as war criminals not be made part of any diplomatic settlement in the Kosovo conflict. In Nebraska, Republican Governor Mike Johanns has to decide whether to sign or veto a measure that would place a moratorium on executions. Johanns, who supports capital punishment, plans to announce his decision at a news conference today. Last week, the Nebraska state legislature became the first in the nation to place a moratorium on executions. The bill would ban them for 2 years while a study is done to see if the death penalty is applied fairly. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And our daily War and Peace report over the last more than 60 days. I'm Amy Goodman, here with my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy. And I'm back after a couple of weeks of being away from the show.
Well, it's great to have you back, but a lot has happened. We are many thousands of bombs later. And the bombshell in New York this week, just yesterday, and that is Justin Volpe, one of the four police officers accused in the attack against Haitian immigrant Abner Louima, pleading guilty to almost all counts.
Yes, and he being the main perpetrator of the assault on Louima, confessed that he actually did engage in the assault on him in a bathroom of a Brooklyn precinct, but of course would not name or say who else was involved. And of course, there will be a major issue now as to whether he will be called to testify and say who else was in that bathroom with him and what the ramifications will be for the other officers on trial.
Right. And this question of whether he will be called to testify is significant because Abner Louima himself, since he was being held face down, could not identify the officer who was holding him in the bathroom. But you can be sure that a lot more officers than Justin Volpe probably know who it was that was in the bathroom with Abner Louima and Justin Volpe. We'll actually talk more about that in a few minutes with the attorney we are joined by now. But first, we're going to go to another kind of brutality, and that is the issue of the war. War in Yugoslavia. We're joined right now by attorney Michael Ratner in the studio here in New York and Jeremy Scahill, Pacifica reporter on the ground in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, Amy.
Well, it's been more than 60 days. Michael Ratner, you're with the Center for Constitutional Rights. You are bringing a lawsuit on behalf of a number of Congress members against the administration for partaking in this war. Can you explain what it's about and why 60 days is such a significant figure?
Well, 60 days is a significant figure because it's the time in the War Powers Resolution after which all troops that are used and forced by the United States have to be withdrawn from the theater of war unless Congress gives its affirmative consent that they can continue with the war. Today is the 63rd day, actually, after the bombing began. The president is absolutely required under the law, under the statute, under the War Powers Resolution to terminate the use of force automatically. Congress should have to do nothing. In fact, Congress in this case has actually voted not to authorize the war. That famous 213 to 213 vote, they said we will not authorize the air war in the House. And so basically, as of today, as of yesterday, really, the president was in absolutely complete, utter, blatant violation of the War Powers Resolution. It's pretty important because that's the actual statute that was passed in 1973 to avoid the United States getting into more Vietnams. It was passed so that the president couldn't continue presidential war while Congress refused to affirmatively approve. So that's where we are right now.
But in terms of that, is there any action planned within Congress itself, or will this have to be settled now in a federal court with your suit?
Well, you know, it's a very sad situation because here you have a law that Congress passed, and you don't see very many Congress people making a stink about it. You have the main plaintiff in my suit, a liberal Republican from California, Tom Campbell. You have Dennis Kucinich, a Democrat from Ohio. I have 25 or so other Congress people. But if I were in Congress right now, I would be making a stink. The president has basically said a law of the United States passed over President Nixon's veto by two-thirds of the House and the Senate is basically being treated as a nullity, and you don't hear a peep. You don't hear a peep out of Congress other than Campbell, who did a small press conference yesterday, not well attended particularly, and you don't hear a peep out of the New York Times. The New York Times puts a piece in today about a lawsuit against Milosevic, which doesn't even have a defendant. They couldn't even serve a defendant. It's basically a publicity lawsuit because Milosevic and the people who did the alleged atrocities are not even here. They put a big piece in today. They don't even put a piece in about a real lawsuit going on to enforce the War Powers Resolution. So you can see both the bias of the press, but also the fact that members of Congress should be screaming to high heaven.
Well, in fact, there's reports now that NATO plans to move ahead with this 50,000-man force to, in essence, commit the ground troops out in the borders around Kosovo. So it seems that NATO is going ahead and the president seems to be going ahead with an even greater commitment. What is there any possibility of being able to get the courts to do a rapid decision on this? Or
well, we've been borderline successful occasionally in the courts, getting them to do very good language, which has occasionally forced the president, such as in Iraq, to go to Congress. In this case, I would hope we would be able to do the same, and hopefully we're going to have an argument, first phase of the argument, next week in Washington. But again, do I expect the court to order the end of the war? Probably not. Do I hope that they say that the president is acting illegally? Yes, I hope they do that. It's an extremely serious situation. Here you have no authority from Congress, one man taking us into war. Basically, really, this is finally burying the Vietnam syndrome with a vengeance. It's finally saying, I'm the president, I'm an imperial president with a vengeance, and I can do what I want, not only in vis-a-vis this country's Congress, but of course vis-a-vis the United Nations as well.
Michael Ratner, attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. And as we said, Jeremy Scahill is also with us from Belgrade, Yugoslavia. Jeremy, what is the latest on the ground as we just reported from the news wires that this is the busiest day yet for the NATO-U.S. bombers?
Well, actually, Amy and Juan, the air raid sirens just sounded about 30 seconds ago here. I'm standing talking to you on a mobile phone in Republika Square in downtown Belgrade. The air raid sirens have just sounded. This follows a very intense night of bombing. More than 17 cities were pummeled by NATO's bombs. People were just starting to get back to normal on the streets because the all-clear sirens sounded about an hour ago. Well, now the air raid sirens have just sounded, and people are bracing up for another intense attack. It's interesting that you're talking about the War Powers Resolution. People here, from people on the street to government officials, are very familiar with the War Powers Act. They even, when I talk to them, joke with me and say, oh, it's been 64 days now. Isn't the president in violation of the law? But they also know that the U.S. is not a favorite. It does not favor the law. They know that this is illegal, that it has no U.N. authorization, and they view the violation of the War Powers Resolution as just part of the same picture of this whole aggression against the country. I should note that I've been talking to a lot of people here on the streets, and I'm sensing an increased rage. People are absolutely fed up. Water supplies are in enormously short supply. Electricity is out throughout 70% of Serbia. People are getting very, very worn down, but they're not getting worn down in their resistance to NATO. They're getting more and more furious. They feel that they're being pummeled by an enemy that they can't fight. Bombs are raining down on their cities, and they don't believe that they can see this enemy, and therefore it's not a fair fight. And some people here are wishing that there would be a ground invasion because they say if they're going to kill us, we would rather have them do it face-to-face like real human beings, real people.
Jeremy, yesterday in the news piece that you filed for the Pacifica Network News, you reported on a news conference held by the Yugoslav health minister on the issue of water, which is a very serious one. And we have that cut queued up. But can you really set the stage for us about what's happening on the issue of water?
Well, NATO has really focused attention on bombing away at the electrical grids in the city. Now, that has had, in the cities of Belgrade and then the two second-largest cities, Novi Sad and Niš, this has had a disastrous effect on people's everyday lives, but it's also directly affected water supplies. Water supplies are down 90% in Belgrade alone. They're down to less than 8% of their reserves because they depend on the electrical system to keep their water pumping. There's a very serious concern and fear here of two things. One is that the water is going to run dry and people are going to flat out be without water. But we also got reports last night that people are now being told to boil their water, which raises fears about the purification system. And, of course, we've seen what's happened in Iraq with children dying of dysentery and waterborne diseases. People here fear that's going to happen to them. And so when the Minister of Health spoke yesterday, she was very, very enraged, and she borrowed from some of NATO's terminology as she sarcastically hypothesized about the reasoning for NATO's targeting of the electrical grids and the water pumps.
Hit. Okay, we're going to go to that in just one second. Jeremy, can you talk a little more right now in terms of how people are preparing in the square you're in? What does it mean to say that people, what, they just run in on and off the street based on the sirens?
Well, there's a couple of different things. I just got done talking to an old man who is out here in the square, and he has picket signs, and he says that he considers it his act of defiance that he doesn't go to the shelters. He stands out here with banners saying NATO Nazi 1939 to 1999. This is a man who was a former member of the military. He's outraged at NATO's bombing, and so he said he won't go to the shelters. Actually, as I look around right now, you see some people walking calmly as though they're used to it, and they feel like there's nothing that they can do. If they're going to get hit, they're going to get hit. But when the sirens went off, I did see particularly some older people starting to actually jog and run a little bit faster. But there's a real diversity at what people's response is. Some people feel that it's an act of resistance, an act of defiance to stand out in the open. People are standing on the bridges. They do stand in the square. And they are really of the sentiment that they feel that they're being attacked unjustly, illegally, and that is not a fair fight. They're just getting sucker punched by the bombs. I think people are getting very, very worn down, not in their resistance, but because life is becoming increasingly difficult on the ground here. And that's all part of the broader picture of attacking these electrical systems and the water pumps.
NATO, Jeremy, we actually do have the clip of the Yugoslav health minister right now talking about particularly the babies in the hospitals that get, well, that face very serious problems, the ones that are in incubators.
Maybe they are afraid that some 800-gram heavy newborn being kept alive in an incubator might become enraged and start shooting at the precious FXX bomber fighter from some of the aggressor countries. Maybe some genocidal patient on dialysis will down some visible or invisible or stealth or unstealth plane. Maybe some pregnant woman will chase out what's been left of the Albanians in Kosovo. Maybe some cerebral palsy child in his wheelchair will chase after NATO troops and thus undermine its security.
The Yugoslav health minister, Jeremy.
Yeah, that was Lepislava Blesevic, who is the minister of health here. She also raised some interesting statistics in her speech yesterday, which was very, very angry. She said that there are 9,500 patients that are receiving intensive and semi-intensive care. She's talking about how the electrical system is going to affect people, that you've got 300 children in incubators that depend on the electrical system to stay alive. You have more than 400 patients with cancer who are receiving chemotherapy. All of this is directly affected by the attacks on the electrical grid and the water supplies. Now, NATO says it's not targeting civilians, and they say they're not targeting the water supply. Well, people here don't believe that, and it's only fueled people's belief and the conclusion that they've come to that the military is not the target here, certainly not in Belgrade, but also elsewhere throughout Serbia, with the exception of Kosovo. They believe that the military is not the target, but that they, in fact, are the target.
Jeremy, in terms of the American journalists who were there, clearly some of the attacks and the so-called mistaken attacks by the NATO forces have had a big impact in the public opinion in this country. What is your sense of how the journalists who you've run into from the United States, what their perspective is on what is happening with the war when they talk personally about it?
Well, I think that you have a mixture of views on this. I think there are some journalists who really don't leave their hotel room, and they rely basically on information that they get from the United States or Britain to file their reports, and they're just filing reports that could have been written in Washington or in London, and they're doing it from hotel rooms here. Now, that certainly is not everyone. I think a lot of people here have seen the destruction, have seen the devastation, and once you've seen that, particularly the hospitals that have been cluster bombed, the marketplaces that have been cluster bombed. I think it's very difficult to keep toting the line from the United States and Britain that this is a campaign against the military once you've seen the destruction. I just this morning talked to a couple of journalists who were saying just that, that they came over here and thought they were going to see one thing, but in fact they've seen another. I mean, when you walk around Belgrade, you do see military buildings that have been destroyed. The police headquarters has been bombed three times, but you also see hospitals and maternity wards and schools, even a 14th century monastery. And I think anyone, as they say, who has eyes to see knows that civilians are the target here.
Well, Jeremy Scahill, we want to thank you very much for being with us on the ground in downtown Belgrade, Yugoslavia, and we will continue to receive your reports every day on Democracy Now! So people should tune in to our daily War and Peace report. Thanks, Jeremy. We are also joined by attorney Michael Ratner, and we'll continue with him in the next segment to talk about this issue of mistaken bombings. And we'll be talking about guns and hopefully go live to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, which is holding a historic hearing today in New York City on the issue of police brutality. Stay with us. What is it? You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. In just a few minutes, we're going to go to listener calls from around the country about what they are doing about the bombing of Yugoslavia and also about the issue of ethnic cleansing of Kosovar Albanians. But we're still with Michael Ratner, attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights, who is filing a lawsuit on behalf of how many Congress members,
Michael? 27 right now, Amy.
And among them?
Among them, leader Tom Campbell, a Republican, California, Dennis Kucinich, Democrat, Ohio, and then you're getting Republicans all the way from liberals to really very conservative from, as I said, from Campbell to Tom Barr.
Bob Barr. Georgia.
Right.
Michael, what about the issue of mistaken bombings? We've gotten everything from the cluster bombings of hospitals to the Chinese embassy. What is your take on that?
Well, I would never use the word mistake or accidental with regard to these kind of bombings. I think you can say two things about them. One is the bombings are indiscriminate and reckless at a minimum, which doesn't mean they're a mistake, which means exactly what they said. They're reckless and you're guilty basically of a war crime when you do that kind of bombing. Secondly, a lot of these bombings are not even that. A lot of them are intentional. The U.S. makes no bones about it, neither does NATO, that it wants to psychologically affect Milosevic and his friends and the people of Yugoslavia. And you're not allowed to do that in war. You can't hit TV stations. You can't hit electrical grids that have a disproportionate effect on civilians, which these do. I think, as Jeremy pointed out, the military has its own generators for carrying out what it has to do. So by hitting electrical grids, you're really hitting civilian population. It's absolutely a war crime. The U.S. at this point, and people have tried to do it already, to raise these issues before the International Tribunal at The Hague, which investigates and has jurisdiction over war crimes in Yugoslavia, and have tried to bring up the United States and NATO before that. There's been a couple of petitions filed because we are really violating the Geneva Conventions, Protocol 1. It's absolutely war crimes. But of course, again, today you saw coverage in the Times of the case against Milosevic, which, as I said, is mostly a publicity case, and you see not a whit of coverage about the fact that there's been major petitions filed in front of the criminal tribunal at The Hague the United States.
Why do you say that that's mostly a publicity case? That was the story that we read at the top of the news about two Kosovo Albanians living in the U.S. suing Milosevic's wife and a dozen other Serb leaders alleging genocide and other war crimes. Why is that publicity stunt?
That's the area of the law that I've done a lot of suits in, whether against General Gramajo or Avril of Haiti and others. And basically, unless the defendant comes into the United States, it doesn't mean anything. I could file 25 lawsuits tomorrow against everybody all over the world, but unless they set foot in the United States, the U.S. court doesn't have jurisdiction. The statute depends on the defendant coming into the United States. None of those defendants are in the United States. So they filed a piece of paper basically with no defendants, not even here to serve. So the lawsuit is not going to go anywhere. It's not even going to be defaulted. There's nobody to answer. You can't serve people who are outside the United States.
And what about the stories that the U.S. government, while waging war against Milosevic and calling him lots of names, Clinton does not call him a war criminal, and the stories that have come out in the international press that, in fact, the U.S. is withholding information to give to The Hague that would allow them perhaps to indict him?
Well, the U.S. is withholding a lot of information from The Hague. The first piece of information it's withholding is the information about U.S. generals or former generals who were involved in the ethnic cleansing of Croatia and kicked out 350,000 Serbs. And the tribunal has wanted that information. The U.S. is withholding that information. The U.S. obviously does what it wants with the tribunal for its political convenience. But if we're going to talk about war criminals, the question is, there's a lot of other war criminals besides Milosevic who should be in front of that tribunal. And we can begin right here at home with the people doing basically the bombing of Serbia.
And, Michael, for those listeners out there who, one way or other, would like to be able to assist in this effort to at least bring our own president here to some measure of responsibility before the law, what can they do?
Well, I think one thing on a local level and even on a national level is get a hold of your congressman and say, what are you guys doing here? This power belongs to Congress. This isn't the president's power. You should be objecting and out there screaming. That's one thing people should do, and that whether it's here in New York or across the country, because a lot of these congressmen, particularly the Democrats, while I think they're against the war, just unwilling to slap Clinton in the face. I mean, some of these guys, Conyers, others, really should be out there screaming. They know this war is no good, both from a legal as well as a moral and political point of view. But they're not fighting. That's one thing you can do. The other thing you can do is obviously, give us a call at the Center for Constitutional Rights, get materials on it, and let people know what's going on.
I have a last question, which is a very weird one. But if you buy the U.S. line, you know, that they are going after Milosevic for the reasons that they say, that there is ethnic cleansing going on in Kosovo, and we do have to point out that there are serious issues of numbers of people who have died as a result of being targeted by governments that are being given weapons by the U.S., like Turkey when it comes to the Kurds, like East Timorese when it comes to the Indonesians, and the Indonesian regime being armed by the United States. And the U.S. continues to do that, but does talk about the issue of Kosovar Albanians. But if you accept what the U.S. says, that we're going to stop this, wouldn't the most effective way to stop it would be to kill Milosevic as opposed to the civilians who have nothing to do with it, and not to mention Kosovar Albanians that are being killed? Why, and I often wonder this, if you use the logic of the war machine of the U.S. government, do they not just go after him and not the civilians?
Well, the most effective way, Amy, would have been to explore and exhaust peaceful means before they started
the war. Of course, but since
I mean, you should have started with the UN and gone into there and really tried to make a deal where you put peacekeeping troops in. But short of that, killing Milosevic, I presume two things are going on, although it's a guess. One is that they want to cut a deal with him in the end of some sort, and therefore they're not going to kill him because they either want to split up Kosovo and to some extent make a deal, keep him in there. And secondly, is the same problem as you had with Saddam Hussein in Iraq. If you get rid of Milosevic or Saddam Hussein, they don't know what's going to happen in the region. There could be generals under Milosevic who just decide, heck with it, let's go into Kosovo and let's really do a job on Kosovo. And maybe even Milosevic is holding that back. You just don't know. It's like with Saddam Hussein. If you killed Saddam Hussein, who knows, the country was going to probably split into pieces. So you don't know what's really going on, although you suspect that in the end the U.S. is going to cut some deal with Milosevic.
But you also feel that given the developments of mass communications now around the world, that what's happened with a lot of the politicians in this country is that they really have gotten to believe that they can wage war without having American casualties and having to then respond to the American people for anybody, any American who gets killed in these events. So, I mean, what's frightening to me is this thing that they've developed now, that they can use the technology and the air power to wage war against a country and have no casualties and therefore have no repercussions at home.
I think that's one of the most dangerous things we've seen in the last few years. And what it does is, because you believe you don't have to be responsible to the people in America, you can press a button, throw some bombs on people, and you don't have to negotiate real hard to get to a peaceful solution. You can simply throw bombs at them. And it means that you're not going to explore any other means. You can throw bombs, no casualties to us, and we can keep throwing bombs forever at them because the American people can keep walking down the street and eating at McDonald's and going to the beach and everything else because none of our children and none of our boys are going to be killed.
What about in the issue of ground troops? Will there have to be some kind of authorization? We're seeing a very surreal scene now. The U.S. saying no to ground troops, but saying they're building up 50,000, quote, peacekeepers on the border. I could only think of the time under Reagan when one of the missiles was either called Peacemaker or Peacekeeper. But what's the difference between a ground troop and a peacekeeper?
Well, in this case, I don't think there's a lot of difference. I think we're putting those troops there for the very reason we started the bombing, which is to try and intimidate Milosevic. And if he doesn't get intimidated, I don't have any doubt that we will use those ground troops. But you do, just like you needed authority for the bombing, you need it for the ground troops. The House of Representatives actually voted that they would not, that the president could not use ground troops unless he came and got affirmative consent from them. Will the president listen to that? Who knows? I mean, this is a fiction, what's going on right now.
You also mentioned, Michael Ratner, the famous 213-213 vote in Congress. I don't think it was so famous. And I'm sure most listeners don't even know what you're talking about.
On April 28th, the Congress had a number of votes. The most important vote was on Senate Concurrent Resolution 21. The Senate had voted to authorize the air war in Yugoslavia. It came to the House for a vote. Is this air war authorized by the House and the Senate together? The House actually, incredibly enough, and we never expected the vote, tie voted 213-213, which means the House refused to authorize the air war in Yugoslavia. So you not only have a president proceeding without congressional consent, what you have a president doing is proceeding in the face of a congressional refusal to back this war. It's basically as unconstitutional as you want to get.
Well, Michael Ratner, we want to thank you very much for being with us, attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights. And he is bringing a lawsuit on behalf of more than two dozen Congress members against the administration for the involvement in this war. I think you said it earlier, but you have said it in conversation before. This the only war since World War II that doesn't have either U.N. or congressional approval?
It's the only war of any significance, other than like a short Grenada stint, that has neither U.N. approval nor approval from Congress. Korea had ostensibly the U.N. Vietnam had Gulf of Tonkin. Iraq had both houses of Congress and the U.N. It's really the first war of any significance since major war since World War II that has had neither. And what is important about that is not just the legal point. The importance of that point is showing what it is saying about a president's ability and the U.S. hegemony and basically U.S. decision to essentially rule the world. It's saying we don't care about the institutions of Congress. We don't care about the institutions of the U.N. We are it. Our word goes.
Well, thank you for being with us, Michael Ratner, and we'll continue to bring everyone the War and Peace report that we do on Democracy Now! And also, Democracy Now! Will be at the June 5th massive protest that is expected in Washington at the Pentagon. Now, last night I went to a teach-in in New York City, and hundreds of people showed up, more than 500 people. This past weekend, The Nation magazine and KPFK, Pacifica Station Los Angeles, held a teach-in at the Leo Beck Temple, I think, in Bel Air, California. And more than 1,000 people turned out. It is remarkable what is happening around this country. And we wanted to give people a sense of what's happening by asking our listeners to call in and let us know what they're doing. And we are being inundated with calls. This is just a few of them.
This is Miles Elledge calling from Orange County, California. Been a listener to KPFK for the last 10 years. I think one of the things that I'd like to comment on is, hi, this is Miles Ellich calling from Orange County, California, and I've been a listener to KPFK now for about 10 years. And like so many other people, here I am making a comment at least to get something off my chest. I feel if it was not for the KPFK, KPFA systems here and across the country, that I would be living in a vacuum. After all the other cable channels and radio channels and TV channels, I feel as bombarded in some ways as the people in Kosovo with things that I am powerless against and cannot do anything. But furthermore, it seems when these major networks send information to me, it's with one idea, and that is like I will purchase something or I will buy something, and then the news, the information is secondary to the idea that I should be a good consumer.
Hi, this is Lucretia Austell. I'm calling from Tampa, Florida, and I don't know the call number of the radio station. It's 88.5 in Tampa, Florida, and I was listening to your comments this morning, and living in Tampa, Florida, our local news is telling us that we may be having refugees from this war coming to Florida, and I'm not really quite sure what the details are of that. I've been out of the country traveling and come back and hear briefly about this on the news. I'm trying to go through my home, clean out, find clothes, find do whatever it is that I can to contribute to this. It's overwhelming to me that Florida does seem to be the landing point for a lot of people who need help, who are escaping wars that our country seems to be starting up for whatever reason. I don't think the reasons we hear on the news are necessarily the accurate or underlying causes for all of this, but it is indeed very frightening to me. And a woman also called in and commented that she was wearing a peace ring on her finger. I watched the Vietnam War as a kid, but I was only 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. And I wondered about it. I was very curious, and I knew that there was something bad going on, but my parents weren't really capable of understanding and explaining it to me as a kid that young. So I think the whole thing is really crazy, and I agree with the guy who called who said he was from Latin America, that as Americans, it's none of our business, really, what other people are doing in their countries. We can't force people to comply to our rules and laws. So anyway, it is very frightening to me, but I'm trying to do my part to help out the people that wind up here as a result of my country bombing people. It's almost embarrassing to be an American citizen right now. But anyway, thanks for listening, and I've enjoyed listening to your radio station. I'm a new listener, and I look forward to listening to you again. Thanks.
Hi, this is Jack calling Joppa, also calling from Tucson. We listen to Democracy Now! And Pacifica News on KXCI 91.3 FM. And I wanted to add to the comments from the woman here in Tucson, which were rather personal in nature, to note that weekly on Thursdays we have been protesting with placards at the federal building, 300 West Congress Street in Tucson, 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. That's been going on for nearly 18 years, a weekly anti-war vigil opposing U.S. military intervention abroad. And so our signs also oppose the bombing and the sanctions against Iraq. There was a teach-in yesterday, Sunday the 23rd, at the Tucson Downtown Public Library. About 85 people attended a Stop the War teach-in. Previous to that, there have been demonstrations at the Earth Day Festival, where corporate sponsor Raytheon was publicly shamed by the Kids for Peace group. And there was a demonstration of about 30 people at the Raytheon missile plant in Tucson at their annual shareholders meeting, saying that no one should make a profit on war. Coming up on June 5th at Downtown Saturday Night, a bi-monthly Tucson event, there will be a protest and march to stop the war. We'll gather at 7 p.m. at the old Union Pacific Station in downtown Tucson and march to the Ronstadt Transit Center for a rally and demonstration against the war.
Some of the listeners who have called in the last day, and we're going to be playing those on a daily basis. So when the corporate media says, where is the peace movement? It is silent. No, it is simply being silenced by the corporate media. And some do actually show news pieces, most recently, I think, because the right is involved as well as the left in these protests, Juan. But you know, when you have a 20-minute piece or a 10-minute piece or a 3-minute piece on the anti-war movement, you're a bit in trouble because it means that it's not getting integrated into the daily commentary of those newscasts.
Oh, absolutely. And I was shocked a couple of nights ago when I saw on the Lair News Hour a whole segment devoted to those who were opposed to the war. But clearly, it It was shocking because it's the only one I've heard of any significance on any of the major media. But I think that it's important for those listeners out there to make their voices heard in any way they can, whether it's through their local media or through their political representatives.
That's right. And I also heard that this weekend on Charles Grodin on CNBC, he had Noam Chomsky on for half an hour. Maybe Pacifica is having an effect. I don't know. Well, keep those phone calls coming in to us. Let us know what you're doing in your part of the world. Give us a call at 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll take a look at guns, money, and politics in this country. House Republican leaders yesterday endorsed mandatory background checks for all sales at gun shows and other steps to keep weapons out of the hands of criminals and young people, virtually ensuring at least modest gun controls will become law this year. The expedited plan to bring the proposals to the floor for a vote in June represent a dramatic shift for a GOP leadership that's staunchly resisted gun control measures in the past and highlights the continuing political fallout from the school shootings in Littleton, Colorado last month. The new measures will be folded into a juvenile crime bill, which many juvenile justice advocates are actually opposing. But on the issue of guns, today we're going to take a look at guns and money. A few days ago, I had this conversation. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and you might have seen an ad last Friday in the New York Times, which highlights the money that some politicians have gotten related to one of the key issues of our day, and that's the issue of gun control and guns, with two shootings at high schools in the past few weeks. The full-page ad said, "Want guns out of our schools? Get gun money out of our politics." And it's got a kind of hall of shame here of 10 Congress members and senators who take money from the gun lobby, and it says gun money in politics, another reason for clean money campaign reform, and gives a website and phone number of Public Campaign in Washington, D.C. We're now joined by the executive director of Public Campaign, Ellen Miller. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ellen.
It's always nice to be with you, Amy.
Well, can you tell us about the origins of this ad and who these people are?
Well, sure. What we've done in this ad is list the top five recipients of gun money or beneficiaries of gun money in both the House and the Senate. You know, as we watched the debate over gun control as it started and as it ended, frankly, what we saw was a kind of issue that wasn't addressed, and it was the role of big money in politics and why gun control policy looks like it does and why it's so incredibly counter to what public opinion is. I mean, this is one of those not rare but sort of clear issues in which the public wants strong gun control. There is, you know, no question about that. But the Congress doesn't. And I think the key reason there is the role of big money in politics. And so we just decided, rather than, you know, just playing along with everybody else who didn't want to talk about this, we decided we'd be the skunk at the garden party. And so we had the analysis done for us, and these are the members who came out on top. And we've had an overwhelming response to this ad, I should tell you, and I hope people will be in touch with us and let us know what they think of it.
Can you tell us how it affected the vote? We're talking about Senator Jim Bunning of Kentucky with $197,000 from the gun lobby. Senator Fred Thompson of Tennessee, interestingly enough, the man who ran the campaign finance investigation of President Clinton, $192,000 from the gun lobby. Senator Bill Frist of Tennessee, more than $186,000. Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, $176,000. And Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania, $105,000. That doesn't touch the Congress members. What about how this affected their vote?
Well, interestingly, they all voted the gun industry's way on these recent debates. Not one of them shifted their position. You know, that's what big money in politics is all about, Amy. It affects what people do because really they have no other choice but to look over their shoulders at their campaign contributors at their next election and say, where is this money coming from? Well, you know, if I take the wrong vote on this, then the NRA isn't going to give me that, you know, nearly $200,000 that each of these members received, between $100,000 and $200,000. And that might mean the difference between election and defeat, so I better go this way on their issue.
I just want to give the Congress members to make sure we don't slight anyone. Congressmember Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, more than $88,000 from the NRA. Congressmember J.D. Hayworth, more than $80,000 from Arizona. Congressman Steve Chabot, Ohio, more than $74,000. Congressmember Rick Hill, Montana, more than $72,000. And Congressmember Merrill Cook of Utah, more than $65,000. Now, this is all straight NRA money?
No, this is actually a combination of money from the NRA, from the gun lobby, in money either direct to the candidates, to the political, well, to these candidates from the gun lobby and from the NRA. What I wanted to say was that this is sort of the tip of the iceberg because, of course, the NRA and the gun manufacturers, which is the bulk of this source of this money, give generously to everyone. In fact, a figure we use here that was calculated for us is that $15.5 million has been spent by the gun lobby since 1991 on our elections, either in independent expenditures or direct contributions to candidates or parties. This is a lot of money. And for them, it's a wise investment. For people who want to keep guns uncontrolled, their money has made a tremendous difference.
How do you get this information? I mean, can anyone tabulate this information on their Congress member or senator?
Well, absolutely. Most of this information is quite easily available from my colleagues at the Center for Responsive Politics. They are the one who track money, and they have a website, and I'm delighted to give you that address. It's www.crp.org, and you can look at your own member of Congress and figure out how much money they have received from the gun industry.
Another thing that unites all of these Congress members, I think, is that they're all Republican. Is that right?
Yes, it is interesting. We certainly would have named Democrats if they had been at the top of this list, but they're not. So this is an ad that targets all Republicans only because that's the way the numbers actually come out.
And what is it that people have said to you when they call in responding to this ad since you've been inundated since it ran?
Well, I have to say the calls are sort of, 10 to 1 in support of the ad, although we've had an occasional caller from a local newspaper as opposed to someone, either in Washington or in New York, who has taken issue with our running this ad, saying that we're fanning the flames of, a public concern over this issue. For us, this is the one issue that no one has really addressed in the public arena. Everyone has said, it's the atrocities committed in Colorado and in Georgia just, at the end of last week were the fault of parents, of children who were out of control, or perhaps it was the kind of medication they were on. They blame everything but the easy access to guns, because if they do that, they have to admit, even the Democrats have to admit, that private money campaign coffers buys something. It buys public policy, and the Democrats can't afford to admit that because in many cases the Democrats are just as beholden to special interests, perhaps not gun-related special interests, but special interests, from Wall Street or Hollywood even.
We're talking to Ellen Miller, who's the executive director of Public Campaign. She's based in Washington, D.C. And as this issue, we take it from just gun money to overall issue of private money and public campaigns. We're also joined now by someone who's been working on that issue in a local area in Oregon. Diane Sands is with us, political director of the Oregon Working Group for Campaign Finance Reform, and she joins us from Portland, Oregon. Welcome to Democracy Now, Diane.
Thank you, Amy. Thanks for having us.
Can you tell us what you're doing in Oregon about this issue of private money?
Well, Oregon is part of the national movement to hold politicians more accountable for this kind of money, huge amounts of money that are going into campaigns, and then being able to track the impact of that money when you actually look at the impact on legislation. And so as part of that, there is a state-based research project that follows the money, and then the campaign for campaign finance reform is looking at putting an initiative on the ballot to create the possibility for candidates to run without having to tap that money so that it would be a publicly funded mechanism for candidates to be able to run and not therefore be either obligated to raise these huge amounts of money, nor will it be beholden in the same kind of way to those money sources once they're elected.
There are a number of different models for these kind of initiatives. Can you explain exactly what you're proposing in Oregon?
Well, Oregon is part of the national movement for a model that was first passed in Maine in 1996. And at this point, we have Maine, Vermont, Arizona, and Massachusetts that have all adopted what we're calling a clean money campaign model. And what it is that it creates a voluntary system, not a mandatory system, but a voluntary system that candidates can opt into where they declare themselves intending to become clean money candidates. They have to raise a certain amount of very small contributions from constituents that qualifies them to become one of these candidates, and at that point they then have access to a specific limited capped amount of public funds in order to be able to run a race. And that's basically how the system works.
And who is arrayed against you?
Well, at this point, and then Ellen may speak to this as well in terms of the other states that have previously passed this, we expect to have some opposition from industry probably, but we don't expect it to be intense. In fact, we're looking forward to overwhelming support from Oregonians who have long been advocates of campaign finance reform. It passed here in 1994 a mandatory contribution limit with a 72% yes vote. So there's a very strong commitment in Oregon, as there has been in these other states, to having some kinds of limitations on the kinds of money that go into campaigns.
Now, Ellen Miller, Director of Public Campaign, Diane just mentioned Arizona having passed this, and yet I see on the list of top 10 money receivers from the gun lobby, Congressmember J.D. Hayworth of Arizona. So if they have this clean money referendum that has passed, how is it that he's getting $80,000 from the gun lobby?
Well, all of the state efforts, including those in Oregon and Arizona, Massachusetts, and Vermont, only pertain to state office holders, usually legislative races or statewide races. So Mr. Hayworth is off scot-free because the law doesn't apply to federal lawmakers. But when this passed in Arizona, what this has done, and I was actually just visiting with Diane in Oregon, Portland, earlier this week, and stopped in Phoenix on the way back to D.C., and when I arrived in Phoenix, there was a story on J.D. Hayworth and how much money he had taken. What a state, even a state-level reform can do is to turn the heat up on federal lawmakers. The terms and conditions for federal lawmakers have to be set in Washington. They can't be set by the states. But what we've begun to do in a state even like as conservative as Arizona is change the political culture about what is regarded as acceptable when it comes to how we finance election campaigns. We think the state strategy will not only demonstrate the viability of a sweeping reform proposal that provides full public financing, but it also will turn up the heat on members who and how they play in the current system.
Now, I went and covered one of your national meetings in Durham, North Carolina, a few years ago. So you're clearly in this for the long haul, and you used to be over at the Center for Responsive Politics and have been dealing with the issue of money in politics for a long time. What gains do you think you've made? I mean, we're moving into the next millennium. We're moving into a presidential campaign year. We see Al Gore and George W. Bush and others raising phenomenal amounts of money. Has there been an effect?
Well, it's a great and difficult question to answer, Amy. Here's the change I think that we have made. We have found thousands of state activists around the country who are no longer satisfied with the status quo, and they want to enact dramatic change. They're not interested in incremental changes. They're interested in this clean money system, which provides the alternative, a truly alternative system to the current status quo. We found overwhelming public support for this kind of proposal. We have two-thirds of Americans across ideological lines, even majorities of Republicans supporting the clean money approach, because the problem of money in politics is simply out of control, and they know it. We have convinced, at least at the national level, many elites. We have a national advisory board filled with elites who are, again, of all political stripes, that the answer, the best answer we can do that's constitutional, is the clean money system. So we put this system on the map, and rather than settle for less and less and less, or fight the battle, which we have lost for years inside Washington, we've taken it outside Washington. I think of it a little like Jericho. We're going to surround the Capitol, and then the walls will come tumbling down, not with just a song and prayers, but with a lot of hard work, including this kind of holding individual members accountable in ways that they may find actually embarrassing.
How has the current administration responded to this nationwide campaign, President Clinton?
Well, I have to say that I think they've mostly ignored it. I think if we look toward the Clinton administration for leadership on this, we'd be foolish. I mean, there is no greater purveyor of the ills of campaign finance than the Clinton administration. And so we do not rely on them for change.
Then you had the McCain-Feingold bill. I'm sure most people don't even know what it entailed, but it didn't get passed.
It's a very modest measure, and it remains stuck, as we like to say, between a rock and a hard place. It has no public momentum behind it because it's so detail-oriented, and they know it won't substantially change the campaign finance system. It's something we support as an incremental change and one that would make a difference, but not in the day-to-day financing of elections. So it doesn't engage the public, and without public engagement, there will be no change here. Interestingly, there was a clip. Diane, why don't you talk about it? A quote from Ron Wyden, Representative Ron Wyden from Oregon, who talked about the necessity of public involvement to change the current system.
And he said, unless it does change in a fundamental way, the reality is that any elected official spends a good deal of time on the phone every day raising funds for their next election. And that is he who pays the tune calls the tune. And so he's really quite clear that, there is a distinct connection between the amount of time and effort that it takes to raise this money and the kind of access you get. And so it's just a fundamental change in the way things are done. And many states like Oregon have really tried very hard in the past to have different kinds of mandatory contribution limits and to try to modify the system and control the impact of money in politics through other mechanisms. And those have now been declared unconstitutional. And so this option not only changes the way campaigns will be run, but it will change who can run. And so we expect as part of this that, many people who just think, I just can't go out there and spend half of my day raising money, or I don't have a private wealth that I can contribute to this campaign, those people will then step onto the field and be able to run. If they have significant community support, they can qualify for these public funds, and they can run, and they can win.
Well, we have to wrap up, but I did want to give information on how you can get in touch with Public Campaign. It's www.publiccampaign.org. That's www.publiccampaign.org. Our guests have been Ellen Miller, Executive Director of Public Campaign, and Diane Sands with the Oregon Working Group on Campaign Finance Reform. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, which has been produced by Maria Carrion and David Love, our technical director, Errol Maitland, Michael Eade, our headlines editor. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, broadcast from the studios of WBAI in New York. We'll